All right, our focus this morning is Bible prophecy. And prophecy, as we think about it, in a very simplified way, has a very pivotal purpose, and that is that we might believe. When we read in John 13:19, Jesus' words, he says, "From now on, I'm telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am He." And Dr. Woods pointed out in the last session that the Bible is unique in this regard. There's no other book that dares give the events before they occur in explicit detail so that those facts could be checked out. We know all the prognosticators that we have today, they play the odds. Sometimes they get it right. Most times they get it wrong. We're amazed when they get it right. We don't look at all the times that they have failed. And we don't realize sometimes that the Bible has hundreds and hundreds of prophecies, not one of them has failed. 100% accurate and always as God said. We can check Him out on that. And the fact that He does ask us to test Him, He does ask us to examine these things, to see where they're so, gives Him and the Bible that kind of unique place. No one, as I say, would dare to do this unless they had the goods. And God's got the goods. So we look at prophecy, we see these things. Now, when we come to a prophecy like the one in Ezekiel 38:39, we're dealing with something that is yet to occur. We've already given the arguments. We believe that this is not symbolic, it's literal. We believe it is premillennial. I'm not sure exactly where in the time before the millennial kingdom it will occur. Many options. But we know that it's still future to our time. And if that's the case, then what is the layout? What are the details? What's the scenario that is in store? And can we, in the days in which we live, see God readying the world, preparing the world for those days? And I'm going to focus on the stage setting largely that is taking place today to, again, confirm in our hearts the accuracy of Scripture, the fact that God is in control. He's not absent from this world. When you turn on the television, you turn on the radio, you read the newspapers, you can see the hand of God in history. And we ought to train our children to be looking all the time for God. You know, there's God, here He is, look, it's happening all the time. And we ought to have that consciousness that He is moving history His way. But of course, we have to know those details ahead of time to be able to recognize what God is doing. So I put a couple passages together. We've already looked more in detail at this. And our focus here is on one of the players in this passage. But notice in Ezekiel 38:39, there is a prediction of a coming invasion. It says, "Lo, I'm coming to deal with you, O God, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Among them shall be Persia, Cush, Put, Gomer, all its cohorts, Bet Torgama and the remotest parts of the north, and all its cohorts, many peoples with you." So an alliance, a coalition of nations in one region, from those in the north to those to the east and west and south of the land of Israel. And he says, "You will come from your home in the farthest north, you and many peoples with you, a mighty army, and you will advance upon my people Israel like a cloud covering the earth." And so from this perspective, this is a massive onslaught. There's absolutely, seemingly no defense against such an alliance. When we look at it, of course, Gog is the name of an individual. He is from Magog, which is a place. And so Gog could be a title, but it's, the idea is that there is someone coming from some place with an alliance of other places that are going to completely overwhelm Israel at some point in history. Now, the text goes on to say, "It will come about on that day when Gog comes against the land of Israel, declares the Lord God, that my fury will mount up in my anger. And in my zeal and my blazing wrath, I declare on that day there will surely be a great earthquake in the land of Israel." It goes on to say, "You will fall on the open field. It is I who have spoken, declares the Lord God. And I will send fire upon Magog and those who inhabit the coastlands and safety." In other words, the destruction here that God brings on this invading army is not just localized in the mountains of Israel, on the fields of Israel, but it even extends to the place from which those armies came. So there's going to be not just a demoralization of that army or a destruction of it that weakens it, but it's going to weaken all of the sending forces as well, so that there's going to be a new shift, a new balance of power that results in this day. But the ultimate result we see at the end of this passage, it says, "And they will know that I am the Lord." And this is a demonstration of God's sovereignty in history so that the nations recognize that He is God. They don't believe that He is the God in the sense they depend upon Him and come to Him as a creator or a savior, but they recognize that they cannot not recognize. I mean, they have to acknowledge that He is. And we know that they resist that and rebel against that and hide from that as we come into the tribulation period. Now, the passage goes on at the end of chapter 39 and gives us good news. And it is that I shall set my glory among the nations. All the nations will see my judgment, which I have executed, and my hand, which I have laid on them. And the house of Israel will know that I am the Lord their God from that day forward. So the result of this is not simply a grudging acknowledgement by the nations of the sovereignty of God, but it is a personal relationship forged with that God by His people Israel. And we see many other factors here. God will have mercy on the whole house of Israel. They will live securely in their land, in this case with no one to make them afraid. I think that's, as we look at the passage, and I'll show you this as well, it talks about Israel dwelling in security when this invasion happens. This, I think, is a distinction because it says not just living securely, but with no one to make them afraid. And I think that there's a type of security, maybe even a false security, that may be thought of. If you say it's the protection brought by the Antichrist, that's certainly a pseudo-peace and a false security. Or if it's even before that, it is their own military prowess and dependence on that. And either way, this is one in which they're secure and there's nothing else to ever shake that security because all their enemies are now reconciled with God. And this is what happens in the millennial kingdom. And then he says, I'll gather them to their own land and leave none of them there any longer. So this is the complete return from exile. And finally, he'll pour out his spirit on the house of Israel at the end of this passage. So that's why I say this has to be premillennial because all these things we know take place in the millennial kingdom. At the end of the tribulation and then on into the millennial kingdom. So this is the outcome or consequence. And it's always good to see this good news before we hear the bad news that this invasion is impending and we may live on the days in which we see that foreshadowed before us. And if that's the case, then we could have fear. But what God is doing is always something greater than what we can see. And the ultimate consequence is His glory, salvation of the nations, and particularly as He has promised salvation of His people Israel. So it's good to see that as we come to these other facts. Now, just for some of you that weren't here in the last session, and to review some of you that were, this Gog and Magog invasion comes from these various coalitions of nations which surround tiny Israel. Looking at this prophecy, we can think of just how contemporary these events are, and I'll explain that to you and demonstrate it for you in the message. But John Ruthven said in a book he wrote on this, great events in history often gather momentum and power long before they're recognized by the experts and commentators on world affairs. Easily one of the most neglected but powerfully galvanizing forces shaping history in the world today is the prophecy of Gog and Magog. This prophecy from the Jewish Christian Bible has molded geopolitics not only within the United States and the West, but also to an amazing degree in the Muslim world as well. Now, he looks at this passage molding things in the sense that God is behind the events that are to come, bringing those events in harmony with what has been predicted. And that's the idea he has here. And we have the same kind of thinking in the Islamic world. They have Majul and Gajul. They have a similar thing. It has different actors in different places and, of course, a very different outcome, but that also molds some of their thinking as well. Now, the question we've looked at is when will this invasion occur? I'm not going to go through some of the textual things that Dr. Woods did. What I'm going to do is look in a more practical way at could we see in Israel today and in the world around Israel events that could already be preparing for and perhaps make this timing event quite contemporary. So let's look at this. We have the different views we've already stated, and because of the text itself, there's some confusion as to when these events might occur. But let's just say if we look at some of these time clues, first we have, in a general way, is when Israel is regathered. It tells us in Ezekiel 38:8, after many days you will be summoned, in the latter years you will come into a land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste. But his people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. I want to look at some of the phrases that are here, just examine in terms of what we know from modern history. So first, when he talks about the land under the sword, the land of Israel for the last 2,000 years has been under foreign domination. And Israel has been scattered largely among the nations. There's always been a remnant in Israel in certain key cities, whether it is Jerusalem or Hebron or Safed or some of these other key cities, Tiberias. They've always been there throughout history, kind of holding on. But for the most part, the Jewish community was scattered in what we call the diaspora, the places outside the land of Israel. And for the last roughly 400 years, before we come to our modern era, we had the Ottoman Empire exercise hegemony. It's control from Turkey, the area where the Ottoman Empire had its area, and its main focus of power was ancient Byzantium, then Constantinople, then Istanbul, which is there today, eclipsing the Christian domination there and making everything Islamic. And so they ruled from afar over this whole huge area, including the area we call Israel. Now, that land that was restored from the sword, most recently from Ottoman rule, ended in 1918 with the First World War and the defeat of the Axis powers, which were the Germans and the Turks in this case. And that land was restored. Now, that was a land that included both what we consider the boundaries of Israel today, as well as the larger boundaries that include the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Because one was under British mandate, other in Syria was under French mandate, and under the mandate situation, the British gave about 80% of the promised land to this Hashemite kingdom, and so that reduced the borders of Israel to what we now have. But the land was that largely land restored from the sword. So that would be the area of modern Israel today. But the text goes on with more precision. It says, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations. Now that's an interesting thing, because when we talk about what happened with the Aliyah to Israel, this movement that started but had one real decisive point when you had, after the Second World War, the Jews that had to come home, had no other place to go. 800,000 were forcibly exiled from Arab lands and had no other place to go but the land of Israel, which would absorb them. And then those fleeing from the Holocaust and many others. It was really the land that was created in 1948 as the State of Israel was a refugee state. And these people came, but they didn't come from one nation. Remember, in the past, when Jews were exiled, they were exiled to Egypt. They came back from one nation, exiled to Babylon. There were still communities in Babylon and other places that came back from Babylon biblically to the land of Judah, so from one nation. Other communities stayed in Egypt, stayed in Babylon, but it was one nation they came back from. And then the exile under the Romans were to many nations, and the first time we have seen a return that would fulfill what Ezekiel says is in our modern period, where we've seen Jewish people coming from all of the nations back to the land of Israel. Now, it's been a partial return. There are Jews in many other parts of the world, and certainly in our own country. But there is a modern state of Israel with Jewish people from many nations. And so that is something that I think we see prepared for in this passage. And then it says, not only have they been to a land restored from the sword, which gives us an historical anchor, And they've been gathered from many nations, which gives us another timing point, but it says, to the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste. Now, the mountains of Israel were not a continual waste in the past. They were developed, but when you talk about the period, particularly under Ottoman Islamic rule, they had a tax on the land based on how many trees you had. And so people cut down the trees, denuded the land. That caused a great deal of conservation problems. There were malaria-ridden swamps in the north. Lake Merom and others were drained by the Israelis so they could reclaim that land. And so it was a waste land. In fact, when we talk about Mark Twain going over in the 1860s, in his book Innocents Abroad, he talks about the waste, desolate condition of the land. You could hardly see a person within 10 miles. Things were just terrible. And some of it's done, of course, in a humorous way, in his way of speaking. But he talks about malaria-infested swamps and denuded land and poor conservation, all the things that happened in this waste land. And that's just the land which we call the land of Samaria, Judea and Samaria, which is today partly the West Bank and Golan Heights. That's the mountains of Israel, the mountainous area. That area, as we know, was returned to Israel in 1967 with the conquest there. So for the first time in history, if you're thinking of a time when could Ezekiel's prophecy have been fulfilled, well, 1948 would be one date, but the mountains of Israel were not part of the possession in 1948. So in 1967, those things return to Israeli control. So we're seeing a mounting preparation, and we could say at least since 67, there seems to be some of these things that are part of the biblical fulfillment. Now we come to the last part, and they are living securely, all of them. Now that's a matter of controversy to many. The term betach we've talked about, it means security, can mean protection, but from what and by whom? If we think of today, bitachon refers to security guards, I mean people who are providing security. When we look at the term here, it says, I will go against those who are at rest, that live securely, who have acquired cattle and goods, who live at the center of the world. If you talk to an Israeli today, I mean, I've lived there, if you visit there frequently, be there another 2 weeks, the whole idea is that for 2,000 years, there was a diaspora. The Jewish people were not at rest. They had no security in the lands to which they went. And the Jewish state was created for that purpose, to give them security and unity and protection. That's why they have a military to defend themselves, a military that's second to none. 5 wars and more have been brought against them, and they have been successful. They claim to have 200 nuclear weapons in the Nimona plant. I mean, they are a formidable force, and their air force and other things are an envy of many of the nations of the world. So in one sense, compared to Israel's past history, their present history is quite secure. And that's why many Jews say, come to the land of Israel. You who are in the nations, come, because the nations are still anti-Semitism. There's not that here. If you want to be at ease, you want to have protection, come to Israel, our national homeland. So it's a perceived security, at any rate. They don't have walled villages, just the old city, which is not where people really live to any extent. And so a lot of the things of modern Israel, the present situation, seem to fit with what could be described here. I don't think this has to have... And if we talk about the protection that Antichrist would afford, and we have an invasion under his watch, under his guard, it seems like, you know, he doesn't really provide much peace, and that would put everybody at odds. But Israel seems to be protected up until we have this surprise invasion by him of the Temple Mount. So there are things that I'm not that I have problems with when we talk about certain views. But I like to think that we have conditions now, at least the preparation for conditions now, that would lead us to the future. And the same thing with the walls around the city. Some have said, well, you have this, you know, fence that's being built all around cities in Israel. Yes, but it's between cities, between Israelis and Palestinians. It's not for protection in the sense of protection from outside. It's for protection from inside. good fences make good neighbors. And this is more for it's a, called a security fence, after all. That's what they call it, security fence. So it's and it can be taken down any time. But 99% of the people live outside that wall, not inside it. So it doesn't violate that idea. When we focus on Israel, there's another condition that's here, and that is their prosperity. Tel Aviv, 100 years ago, was simply a sand dune. And it's a city of more than 1 million people. We look at the skyscrapers, we look at the development, we look at the military. And so there's something about Israel that stands alone. The 70 years of its existence are unparalleled in world history. Not just from the idea that people who never, in 2,000 years, had a homeland, that restored an ancient language, that came back and had an independent state, but have built that state into something that's envy of the world. And perhaps, as we've said, is about to have wealth that's also sort of off the board in terms of the world. If the gas deposits and oil deposits and other things materialize, their technology and other inventions and things that are there too are setting Israel apart. And of course, those of you that have cell phones know that was developed largely in Israel as well. Now, there's a second timing clue here, and that relates to when Israel's enemies gather. Israel has to be in the land, and as Dr. Woods pointed out, has to be there in unbelief. So the problem of a secularized Israel, for the large part, is not a problem because the Scripture says they would come back in unbelief, and it's in that place where they come to faith or come to belief at the end of the tribulation. So all of this is something that was clearly understood in Scripture. But it was also understood that there will be those who go against Israel. Israel is going to be hated by all nations. It's going to be the focal point of their envy, but also of their wrath. And it says here, to capture spoil, seize plunder, turn your hand against the waste places now inhabited, which is what has happened, of course, when we talk about the so-called West Bank and the Golan Heights. They're a controversial area for the nations and against people who are gathered from the nations. So this is one of the things. We look at the people involved, and just to review this for you, we have the ancient name and modern name. All names we're familiar with, all countries which are involved in the modern Middle East conflict. And so these are the ones, just to review this, Rosh is Russia, Magog, the satellite Russian states, Meshach, Turkey, Tubal, Gomer, and Beit Torgama, also parts of Russia, parts of Turkey. And then we have Kush, Sudan, and put Libya. And then the key one we're going to look at in this hour, Iran, which is ancient Persia. Look at them on a map. You can see how, from the perspective of Israel, now not from our perspective, perspective of Israel, we have Magog in the north, and we have the other countries aligned around it. So these are very key countries, and we're going to see in a moment how they're already in a coalition. Not you know, has yet to come, they're already in that kind of political and military coalition. And there's Israel in the middle. Now, it's not just when Israel's enemies gather to the region, it's when they unite. And so that's the key point here. They come out of the remote parts of the north, you and many peoples, a great assembly. And so looking at this, we've said Rosh means Russia, historical support for this comes from many places. I have more details in my commentary, but Egyptian inscriptions, Assyrian inscriptions, you come to Ugaritic, other languages, cognate languages to Hebrew in the Bible, all use this in this way. And when we talk about linguistic support, we can see that this lent itself to the topographical features in the Ukraine, which are now Russia, in this area. And the ancient Scythians, as Josephus says, inhabited this area. So whatever name it's called, it's the geography that has remained the same. And the people now, of course, are these ancient people. But we believe that they got their name, Russia, from the ancient source, Rosh. So it comes from that. Now, the third time clue here deals with the focal point of this invasion. And Zechariah 14:2 says, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Ezekiel 38:39 does not say Jerusalem. Many people will put this passage in connection with Zechariah 12 and Zechariah 14, and it could be. I mean, it doesn't tell us. The mountains of Israel include Jerusalem. They never get there, and I don't think these are the same battles. But at the same point, we see that there is a growing, massing desire among all of these nations to solve the problem of Jerusalem. This is the unstable factor. This is what has kept the peace process from coming to pass. And so it's part of that. So when Jerusalem becomes the focus of a global conflict, which it is, then we put all these pieces together. Here is Global March on Jerusalem this year, Land of Palestine Day. The people of the world demand the liberation of Jerusalem. And in fact, that is the international community wants to enforce its will on Israel to resolve the situation of Jerusalem. They consider it an international city. Our own embassy, our own state position is that Jerusalem is not the capital of Israel. We will not put our embassies there. And we actually try to influence others not to do that as well. We think about this. Here's a little cartoon from the Jerusalem Post, Dry Bones. Man is reading the newspaper and he says, "And the nations of the world did come against Jerusalem and did threaten the children of Israel." And his wife says, "Are you reading from the Bible?" "No, dear, I'm reading from the newspaper." Because the events of the newspaper dovetail so well with the things predicted in the Bible. So we want to ask ourselves, where are we now? If we talk about Ezekiel 38-39, which we did in the last hour, how close are we to the fulfillment of these kind of events? And I just want to paint a picture of these things. Talking about Russia, which would be the lead country in this end-time invasion, and Dr. Woods inferred this in what he said. Here are some of the statistics on this. Out of the 10 million people in Moscow, 2.5 are Muslim, a fourth of the population. Ethnic Russians are in net population decline. The Muslim population has increased by 40% in the last 15 years. And this is an older statistic, so it's increased even more. 7 out of 10 Russian pregnancies are aborted. By contrast, in Muslim communities, the fertility rate is 10 babies per woman. Russians are older, have record rates of heart and liver disease, drug addiction, and AIDS. The Muslim community is younger and free of such afflictions. So just in a demographic way, you see that Russia, if you think, why would Russia, you know, want to invade Israel? Well, it has had those ambitions for a long time. But now that it has this increasing Islamic influence, and in time, let me just add this, because we're going to see the Russian army become dominantly Islamic as well. In that case, then the military agenda would certainly fit with the agenda of the Islamic countries. And that kind of thing is happening. This statistic came from 2006, and so it's saying by 2015, Muslims will make a majority of the Russian army. That's not far away, friends, a couple of years. So we're on the verge of those things. Look at some of the news articles pulled off the internet. Russia shows off combat readiness, or Russia's arms sales to Iran and the Arab world concern the U.S. and Israel, or Russia has 5 arms deals with Libya, or the Sudan and Russia forging ties, or here's this axis, Russia, Iran, Sudan, and China, but you see 3 of our players in there. Russia approves additional reactors for Iran, or Russia set to boost military technical ties with Iran. By the way, you know, we have right now the Iranian army and the Turkish army doing joint military operations. They were doing that while I was in Turkey. But Russia becomes Turkey's leading economic partner. So Turkey's brought in. Russia warns Israel not to attack Iran, and so there's threats from that point. Turkey's prime minister in Iran for talks on nuclear program. So you see the alliance forming that's there. Turkey, Russia, launch defense corporation talks. War games exercises. Israel-Turkey relations hit new low. Last year when I was in Turkey, and I'll show you one of the headlines, it simply says, Turkey is finished with Israel. They used to have military alliances. They severed all of those over the flotilla incident. So now we have a situation in which they have forged alliances with Iran and are against Israel. Here's the newspaper title in Turkish. Turkey is finished with Israel. So all this is coming together. some interesting little insights, too, that people have brought out. Ezekiel 39:9 talks about those who inhabit the cities of Israel will go out, make fires with the weapons, burn them. And someone says, well, see, now that has to be a past event because people don't use wooden weapons anymore. They have just, it talks about shields, bucklers, bows and arrows, war clubs and spears, and 7 years they'll make fires of them. So, you know, and I see this as phenomenological language. That means that the prophet in a vision is giving descriptions of what he sees. He doesn't know what to call modern weapons. So he simply calls them by the names of the kind of weapons they represent. And if we look at very interesting things, here are some combustible weapons devised by Russia, which are in use today. These are the different types of weapons, but the wood stocks, actually all parts of this are burned. The weapons are made of lignite, a carbon fiber mixed with paper that's harder and denser than steel, but is also highly combustible. So if this is the, and I'm saying it is, it would be I'd be timing it perhaps too precisely, but I'm simply saying if we have little details like that we're skeptical of, we can see that there even that is covered in some of the contemporary things. Russia wants in on Israel natural gas industry. Leviathan and Tamar, these two offshore drill sites for Israel, Russia wants to forge a partnership with Israel on this because they want what they've got. They want to get in on it. So you can see all these kind of things going. And Ezekiel 38:4 talks about a hook put into the jaws, some kind of incentive, some kind of inducement, something that draws them to that country. We don't know if this is the case, but we can see how it could be. It's quite plausible today. Putin, when he took power, forged these alliances with Iran. Billion-dollar arms deal back in November of 2005. Same thing we have with Syria going on. But they oppose. Russia has allied itself with Syria to strengthen its ties, but it has a deal with Iran. Iran and Syria share borders. And so part of this is to try to hold on to its also relationship with Iran. That brings us to Russia and Iran. And I want to look at that because we're moving to look at Iran in more detail. As I said, $1 billion arms contract, a deal to establish a joint uranium enrichment venture, which simply says there is already this kind of partnership. The Torium-1 missiles to help protect against any possible airstrike by Israel, these type of things. And so that leads us to the question of Iran. Iran, ancient Persia, the first country mentioned after Russia in the list of these allied nations. So what place did it play? Well, I think there was a preparation for political ascendancy as we look at the past. 1979, we've mentioned this is a very pivotal time. I think it's a turn in events which puts Iran in the place of fulfillment of prophecy. Not present fulfillment, but prepares it for that fulfillment. The Shah of Iran, which was had a very Western influence, allied with the United States, for instance. That ended in 79 with this Iranian revolution, and the Ayatollah Khomeini came in which we had now a strictly Islamic construct, a theocracy formed where before we had a kind of monarchy. And when a war against the West began, this is when we first heard the statement that America was the great Satan, Israel was the little Satan. I was living in Israel when this happened. I remember the hostage situation. I remember when Carter tried to send an attack team to try to, you know, rescue the guys, and it failed. And I went to school that morning, and a bunch of the French guys were telling me, you know, you guys, you know, all got killed, and just failed attempt. And some of the Israelis said, we could have done it. You know, why didn't they ask us? You know, like, of course, you had to live with that. But it was, I know when our daughter was born in Hadassah Hospital, I was sitting right next to a guy who had escaped from Iran, and his wife was having a baby same time we were having a baby, and he was telling me about, you know, had to get out because things had changed so radically in Iran. Well, the West became targets, and particularly Israel and the United States, because of their own relationship, the Judeo-Christian history that is there. We look at the effect of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Here is Reza Khalili, who was an ex-CIA spy He can't reveal himself. He wrote in a book, Time to Betray, and he explains this. He converted to Christianity, and his book was a bestseller. He says, the mullahs forced Iranians to adhere to a strict Islamic dress code. It subjected them to amputation as the punishment for stealing, lashing, for drinking, stoning, for adultery, all of these things. Boys and girls seeking the freedoms promised to them were rounded up and taken to Evin prison. Many of them were raped, tortured, and executed, among them my best friend and his siblings. Teenage girls were raped prior to execution because in Islam a virgin could go to heaven and the men of God wanted to deny them that reward. Others were slowly lowered into tanks of acid so they would die painfully. Khomeini and his clerics announced themselves as representatives of Allah on earth and declared anyone opposed to them to be muharrab, enemy of God. The punishment was execution. Tens of thousands were executed. So we can see there was a real shift, a real change that took place at this time. Iran's past president, Khatami, even at that point, was declaring things about Israel. He says Iran wants to destroy Israel. It wasn't Ahmadinejad, the first person to say it. This guy has said it. And he said, since Israel was a small country and could not sustain a nuclear attack by a larger country, Iran was willing to pay the price of collateral damage from a nuclear exchange with Israel in order to exterminate it. So you see some of the mentality. Now, that's what happened politically. But now there is also a preparation for an apocalyptic destiny. And I have no doubt they believe that they are part of an end-time prophecy and that some of their key figures, like the Ayatollah and like the president, are actually written into the script to fulfill these things. So when we talk about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the present president, this is his last term supposedly, we see Iran going nuclear. Iran has their own timeline for enriching uranium. But we saw that he said in the UN back that Israel must be wiped off the map. He also said it again at this World Without Zionism conference in 2005, which was held in Iran. What's interesting is you look at this conference, we have these signs in English. Their language is Farsi. Why would they have these signs in English? Well, they have them there because they want the media and the world to see what they're doing and understand that their threats are genuine. So they have a globe behind them of the United States. In fact, here is one of their graphics. And it shows the world and dropping out from the world, being removed from the world, being eliminated from the world, is the state of Israel. But already at the bottom of the, let's say the ground, is the United States, the stars and stripes, and here it is smashed. So the idea is that we have to somehow weaken Israel's western defense, which is the United States, before we can attack Israel. So we can't just passively sit here and watch these things unfold and say, well, we're not going to get involved. We'll just let other people work it out. It does involve us if we listen to what they are saying. Khomeini called Israel a cancerous tumor that must be excised. He had a young crowd chanting death to Israel, death to Israel. Israel is a cancerous tumor, be cut out, all right? Iran is willing to target U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, which has been done with attacks. Okay, from now on, it says, in any place, in any nation, any group confronts the Zionist regime, we will endorse and we will help. So it doesn't matter who it is. So that's why, of course, Hezbollah is a Iranian construct. Hamas is supported by Iran. So we have all of these nations or entities, organizations attacking Israel that are from Iran. Khomeini affirmed that Iran had assisted Hezbollah, Hamas, all of these. And even in Syria, the leader at that time had massacred 5,400. I think it's up to 20,000 or more now. I can't remember the latest statistic. And Iran is behind that as well. Iran and the U.S., well, some of these statistics are old. I don't want to. We know that the red line has been drawn now, at least by the Israelis. But in response to U.S. statements of concern about the buildup, they simply replied, may the undertaker bury you, your table, and your body, which has soiled the world. According to top U.S. intelligence officials, the plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States shows the Iranian leadership is more willing to conduct an attack on U.S. soil in response to real or perceived actions that threaten the regime. They have sleeper cells, we know, throughout our country. The Iranian leader warns the U.S. and Israel against such kind of strikes. We have that kind of thing. Or Iranian commander says we must destroy America. Or we have statements like one of the Israeli commanders says Iran is getting ready to produce a missile with a range of 10,000 kilometers. That's the great Satan, aimed at America, not at us. And we know recently they've increased even the range of this. So the thought is, if they wanted to, they could simply send an offshore device to the United States. It could hit somewhere in the homeland, and with EMP device or whatever it was, take out a lot of our population. So, and they have no qualms about stating that they would do something like that. There are at least 27 sites in Iran where a nuclear program is being developed. We know some of these statistics. Iranian officials says the world must accept Iran's civilian nuclear program or incur heavy losses. So all of these things are part of it. And our national security strategy, at least from 2006, and this has not changed, it says the number one threat to our national security is Iran, okay? not some others. When we look at an analysis, U.S. is thwarting Israeli strike on Iran. Well, that was one people's thing. Is that what the United States is doing? And yet, if you think of what our president, his position is quite passive on this. Trust sanctions. Let's enter into negotiations. Let's keep, basically won't meet with the Israeli prime minister. All of these things are simply to defer and delay instead of being involved with something controversial or try to take some particular side. And he said, we mustn't lose sight of this thing, that is the roadmap to peace, while Iran is threatening Israel's even existence. All right. Here's another one. Can't you guys put this on hold until after our election? All the fighting that goes on, you know, that kind of thing. Well, when we talk about what was going on, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and this is not him speaking, this is actually the Ayatollah, who is the spiritual leader. We have a supreme Islamic leader over Iran. So whoever the puppet president might be, of course, he has to agree with him, but he comes and goes, but we have this control from the Islamic leader. And he says, we have to turn Iran into a modern and divine country to be the model for all nations, which will also serve as the basis for the return of the 12th Imam. In other words, it's a theocracy. It was constructed in 1979 to be that, to rule over other nations, to be the model for other nations. And that's why we have Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said, we don't shy away from declaring that Islam is ready to rule the world. Here are other statements. Iran's apocalyptic leaders believe that a medieval holy man will reappear in the wake of a devastating holy war, thereby ensuring that the brand of radical Islam will rule the world. That's not just what they believe, that is what they're actually, that's their guiding their policies, according to Netanyahu, and their actions. And that's what he said in his UN speech. This isn't just theory, this is practice. This is what they're doing. Most of us don't understand this thing about the 12th Imam. Well, in Iran, his birthday is celebrated like we celebrate Christmas, with fireworks and days off and all kinds of things. He is the awaited Messiah. Let's look at what Islam teaches. In Iran, it's Shia Islam. In other places like Iraq and most of the Arab world, it's Sunni Islam. But Shia Islam and Sunni Islam agree on this figure. One calls him the 12th Imam because they have a certain amount of imams, and this is the last, the 12th. So they're the 12ers, they call themselves. He's called the Mahdi from the Sunni side. So we'll interchange that term because it's the same individual. According to the Hadith, in the age of the coming, a revolution takes place in Iran. This is a key sign indicating that the reappearance of the Mahdi is near, and serves as the initial preparation of the worldwide movement for the coming of the last Messiah. This is all from the Iranian press, by the way. Based on this belief, the leaders of Iran see it as their duty to prepare the ground for the coming. One of the most important events to securing the reappearance of the last Messiah is the annihilation of Israel and the conquering of Jerusalem. The Iranian government states with confidence that Islam will soon conquer the world and all infidels will be destroyed. the pursuit of nuclear bombs by the radicals ruling Iran, and this is not from their press, by the way, is directly connected to this belief, as war, chaos, and lawlessness must engulf the world to pave the way for the Imam Mahdi's appearance. So coming of the Imam, and this is from the Iranian World Toward Illumination, which is their national sort of propaganda service. But they control the press and everything, and this is what they put out. The Mahdi will arise from Mecca, and all of Arabia will submit to him, and then to other parts of the world as he marches upon Iraq and establishes a seat of global government in Kufa. Then he will send 10,000 of his forces to the east and to the west to uproot the oppressors, that is, the enemies of Islam, and one land after another will come under his control. The last of his apocalyptic battles will be the overthrow by his troops of his arch-villain in Jerusalem, the Islamic holy city in Palestine, currently under occupation of the Zionists. And the enemy, they see, is the Jewish Antichrist, known as the Dajjal, which this guy is to overthrow. So they see Israel as a Satan, as a corruption, as someone that's polluting the world, that Western influence, aiding and abetting it, is sharing in that corruption. And they are the great heroes that are going to deliver and restore the purity of Islam. And they await the 12th Imam. In 1979, when this republic was established, it was based on the construct of the 12th Imam. Article 5 of the Constitution for the Islamic Republic of Iran proclaims the basis for the government is the authority of the 12th Imam. Over 2 million Iranians believe Khomeini was the expected one. He said, no, I'm just coming to prepare for his appearance. Kind of like John the Baptist prepared for the coming of Jesus. 90% of the population of Iran, 60% of the population of Iraq, belong to the group of Shia Islam known as the Twelvers, who await the 12th Imam. In 2007, and more has been said since then, but Mahmoud Ahmadinejad claimed to be in touch with the 12th Imam, said he will definitely return in 2 years. Well, he didn't return in 2 years. Or did he? According to him, the Arab Spring and everything that has happened since has been the work of the 12th Imam. He's bringing about this chaos in the world, which is paving the way for his needed appearance. So he says he's going to appear soon. Looking at this from a scriptural point of view, the Bible tells us that as we move toward the time of the tribulation, when false prophets will be rampant, that false prophets will arise. John, in his epistle, told us that already many antichrists have come into the world. So they are here, but we see this in particular in someone like this, who stages these things. So the Imam Mahdi is certainly one of the false prophets, one of the antichrist, not antichrist, and I say that because there are people who do have that position today, which will arise. They say that on the basis of some of the clerics' writings about this individual. In other words, the prophet said he will divide the property. He will govern the people of the Sunnah and of their prophet, establish Islam on earth. He will reign for 7 years. And then die. The prophet said the Mahdi will fill the earth with equity and justice. As it was filled with oppression and tyranny, he will rule for 7 years. Well, that 7 years seems, you know, pretty familiar to some of us who know that. So that's why people want to equate him with the Antichrist we see in the scriptures. Although I don't think that's the case, but he certainly fits the pattern of many Antichrists who have come. I think in every generation, Satan is grooming someone to fulfill that role. There are many people getting very close as he looks at the world situation and tries to bring that to pass. He doesn't know the future. He doesn't know the time of the return of Christ. He doesn't know when the rapture is going to happen. He doesn't know any of these things. So he's always preparing it. And so there's always someone ready for that role. But and this could be a guy like that, but he's not going to fulfill that role, we don't think. So we have all these alliances formed. Ahmadinejad says destroy Israel. The solution to the Middle East crisis is to destroy Israel. And so we know that from the news, Israel stands ready to attack Iran's nuclear sites. It's tried to mess up things through computer viruses and various other things, blown up a few little things that have set things back. But these things are too pervasive, too deep, too hidden. They know they can't get everything. The best they can do, even with an attack on Iran, is simply delay things for a time. And Iran is playing, of course, a dangerous game with Israel, because Israel is stating to the world that there is a red line. Something has to stop. Israel's readying its forces for an attack. In the meantime, you know, when you hear these things, maybe Iran should step back. Maybe these sanctions should force them to rethink things. I mean, their economy is suffering. Their currency has dropped. All kinds of things have happened. Do you think that's a deterrent? I mean, in the United States, if our gas prices had quadrupled, if we had massive unemployment, we would be on our national leaders to do something tomorrow. You see the riots in Greece that's happening because of their debts and the problems. In Iran, no such thing. Can't happen. And here's one of the reasons why they don't care what happens, because they put out a film called The Coming Is Soon, that the Mahdi is here, that he's going to conquer all through the world. He has said that the reign of the 12th Imam on earth will bring about an eternally bright future for mankind, not by force or waging wars, but through thought and awakening and developing kindness in everyone. Okay? Yeah. Well, sure. Well, this was his speech, last week. He says he didn't offer a specific timetable, but he did say that the sweet scent of the Mahdi's global reign will soon reach all the territories in Asia, Europe, Africa, and the U.S. And, of course, he started this with a prayer to hasten his coming. This film they produced shows that Iran plans to conquer the world, Israel and the world. There are many things on this that say the Mahdi is near, Israel will be destroyed, the coming is here. Here's a description of the documentary. This documentary called The Coming Is Soon. I mean, this is on a national level. What if we had our government put out something that says, Christ's coming is soon, put on the front pages of the paper, had a film that was not only in Farsi, but being translated into Arabic and sent around the world to all the troops. We'd think something amazing was happening. Well, it's what's happening there. This film claims that the Ayatollah Khomeini, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Hassan Nasrallah, are all talked about in Islamic prophecy. They're leaders who will wage war to bring about the arrival of the hidden imam, which they say is very close to happening. Now, if you thought you were written into the script, if you could turn to Islamic prophecy, that's me. You think you'd be deterred by anything happening in your country, by any threat from the West or from Israel? Not a chance. You want to bring in this glorious thing. The sin is in the air. The purpose of the film is to make the case that Iran is prophetically destined to lead the war against Islam's enemies as a prelude to the appearance of the Mahdi and bring about final victory for Islam and then reign over the whole world. It uses current events, and just like we're doing in this conference. Okay, it uses the same current events to argue that the Mahdi's on the scene, that things are happening, that they're the people, and that the final chapter has begun. The Mahdi's arrival is imminent. It proclaims that Khomeini, Ahmadinejad, Nasrallah are the individuals that will make this happen. Here is Efsvendar Rahim Mishael, the top advisor and chief of staff to the president. He says, therefore, let us shout out loud that the coming is soon and that evil should be fearful. We live with these thoughts every day, and our lives are filled with the coming of the last imam. That human will reappear and fill the world with justice and establish his promised governance on earth. The very world has witnessed too much bloodshed of the innocent for others to build their palaces. The very world is filled with shouts for justice. The innocent and the oppressed are losing their lives to world powers. And again, as was said here, what about Iran? But of course, no cost is too great to pay to bring in this kind of revolution. It's this very world where the oppressors rule, and this world that Allah will command the last imam to appear and forever put an end to injustice. At that time, the world will belong to the righteous. All right. So you could say, this is deception of the highest order. This is the kind of thing I think it's even characteristic of the coming tribulation. People, you know, it talks about how Jewish people will kill you thinking they're doing God a favor. And in the future, there are people who will be aligned to this global government who think that, you know, it's been blessed and it's going to bring the promised peace on earth, that the false Messiah is the true Messiah, and buy into the false signs and wonders and all these type of things. But the only way to avoid that kind of deception is, of course, to know the truth. And that's why I'm very disturbed when I see churches growing in size but not in spiritual strength. They are doing everything they can to reach the masses, and a lot of the teaching is very practical, but people don't know the Word of God. And so it must be a way to do both, okay? We need to be firmly rooted in the things that God has said. And people avoid prophecy because they're afraid it's going to divide things. All the nuts will come out of the woodwork. All the pastors will be perturbed. And the pastors, of course, don't know the subject. They weren't taught that well in school. It's too difficult. It's too controversial. So they want to avoid that. It's never said. And if you do expository teaching, you can't avoid it. So you don't do expository teaching. You do more of a topical message, so you can always tailor it to what you think people need. And so we have a generation in the church that is losing this foundation, and without it, there's going to be a massive deception that sweeps through the world, which is why conferences like this are so important. Now, what this Iranian production reveals is the film has been approved by, of course, the spiritual imam, and the leader of Iran. It fulfills their roles. The film is being screened throughout Iran for military officers and soldiers, as well as for paramilitary units, prepare their forces for rapidly approaching genocidal war against Israel, United States, and the West. It's being translated to Arabic for distribution throughout the Islamic world to provoke a jihadic war with Israel and the West. They do not have the freedom of information that we have. I don't know how much we really have, but I mean, we at least have an uncensored internet. They don't. Okay? When I'm over in Turkey, I can't get whatever I want. My email is read. My phone calls are listened to. There's no freedom, even over there in a country that is considered still more Western than the rest of the Arab world. And so, you know, we don't realize that these people are fed one thing and that's all they know. So they believe it. The Mahdi, of course, is predicted to arrive in a time of chaos. So what do you want to do in the world? You want to produce chaos. It's an international conflict that precedes his coming or requires his coming. Okay? If you have a problem, he's going to solve it. So you create a problem. So the chaos presently in the Middle East, the Egyptian revolt, Libyan revolt, Syrian revolt, Yemeni revolt, the problems we've seen with all the reactions recently on the Arab street are all part, they say, of the preparation for this guy's coming. This unrest throughout the Islamic world is simply the cry for Mahdi to come soon. And they interpret it that way. This will be the war of the 12th Imam. Khalili says that for the first time, Iran's highest-ranking military official has tied the appearance of the last Islamic Messiah to the regime being prepared to go to war based on ideology. And here is Ahmed Vahidi. This is from the news run by the Revolutionary Guards. This is the defense minister. He says, with having the treasure of the holy defense, Vahalat, guardianship of the jurist and martyrs, we are ready for a big war. Of course, this confrontation has always continued. However, since we are in the era of the coming, of the imam, this war will be a significant war. So they look for that. Israel knows all of these facts, and so we have been taught to think, when will Israel attack? When's this going to happen? But if you read Ezekiel 38-39, Israel doesn't attack. This isn't a war launched by Israel. And so we should say, when is Iran going to attack? Or Russia or the others, if this would be that war? We can't say that it is. We can certainly see that it possibly could be. Here is Amir Ali Hajizah. Can't pronounce it, sorry. Brigadier General in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. He says Iran could launch a preemptive strike on Israel if it was sure the Jewish state was prepared to attack it. Well, we've seen their army. They say that the Zionists are no match for their military. An Iranian lawmaker says that Israel will be annihilated if it attacks Iran, as the Zionist regime does not have the military ability to confront the Islamic Republic's armed forces. And so, will Israel attack? Well, Israel hasn't said that it will attack. It has simply told the world that the red line exists. This spring, this summer, they know from their intelligence that Iran will be at the place where it could weaponize its missiles, and it could send this kind of attack. Whether it's a nuclear attack or whether it's simply ballistic attack, whatever it is, they believe this attack is going to come. So if that's the case, what could happen? Well, the response to this kind of thing, if you remember what was said just last week, the fake regime of Israel is mocked by everyone in the world today, although such cheap actions of the leaders of the occupying Zionist regime are nothing new. So no one takes it seriously, other than Israel and perhaps some of us who read the news through the eyes of the Bible. But Iran has been targeting Israel. Of course, Israel is targeting Iran. And we're at this stage of conflict. So we've seen already an armada of their national naval power massing in the Gulf. People are very worried about the Straits of Hormuz. If that is blocked and what that means, that's an act of war in itself. We have some of our destroyers out there on what we call naval exercises. But cruisers, aircraft carriers, minesweepers from 25 nations converged on the Strait of Hormuz in an unprecedented show of force. Some people do believe that something could happen. A blockade, of course, of the Strait of Hormuz would have catastrophic effect on the fragile economies of Britain, Europe, United States, Japan, all which rely heavily on oil and gas supplies from the Gulf. Another reason for us to develop our own resources, right? So we don't have to worry about these people. But the Straits of Hormuz is one of the most congested international waterways, only 21 miles wide, and is bordered by the Iranian coast to the north and Oman to the south. In preparation for any preemptive or retaliatory action by Iran, warships from these 25 countries, including the United States, Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, will begin an annual 12-day exercise. So some of the Arab countries are just as concerned about this because Iran is an unstable force. Iran and Iraq, of course, had an 8-year war in the past. They may have the same mindset about the coming of the Mahdi, but they don't have a good mindset about an Iranian government and their own ambitions to rule over them. So, Mideast madness, all the things that could happen, the problems we see of the fearful nuclear weapons falling in the hands of people who think they want to rule the world for a religion that says that Christianity is false, the New Testament is a forged document, the Old Testament is a corrupted book, that they will execute Christians in certain parts of the Islamic world simply for having a Bible, carrying a Bible, trying to print a Bible. I personally know people who were executed that way with their throats cut for doing just that. So what can we do? First, let's just remember that we have the sure word of prophecy, and God has said not to fear. He's in control. He's always in control. He is the one who holds the whole world in his hand, and that world includes Iran and Russia and Libya and Sudan and Turkey and everybody else. Okay? The nations are like a drop in the bucket. They're like dust on the scales. God is in control. The scriptures remind us that in Psalms 115, verses 2 through 3, why should the nations say, where now is their God? Our God is in the heavens, and he does whatever he pleases. Right, he is a sovereign God, and that's a word of great comfort. And then we have the statement, as I mentioned in Isaiah 40, the nations regarded as nothing, a speck of dust on the scales. God made them, and God can unmake them. He can take them out. He is in control. And he has an order for these things, which bring us not to the coming of a Mahdi or an Imam, but come to the true Messiah, who will then rule this world in true peace and justice. So that's the second point. Don't fear, because God is in control, but take comfort because Christ is coming. God has a plan. His plan is perfect. And the scriptures remind us that in 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 through 18. We've heard the words many times, but this is not simply for a graveside ceremony. This is for every day of our life. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout. We who are alive and remain shall be caught up to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we will always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. Great comfort in these things. Now, we're not wanting to just, you know, escape from our problems and get out of this world. No, no, no. We want to see the next things that God has, and God has to remove us so he can do those things. That's the great hope we have. That's why it's called a blessed hope. We're not looking for, you know, the undertaker. We're looking for the uppertaker. We're not looking for the Antichrist. We're looking for Christ. Right? Okay. So comfort one another. Remind each other when someone tells you about all their sorrows and woes. And like Dr. Woods says, not one problem that the rapture cannot cure. Okay? But it's because we're going to be with him. That's the thing, that's the reason we long for it. All right. He's the blessed one and he's the blessed hope. Third, warn others to flee the coming wrath. Look, if there is a reality to these things, then how can you deny it? You can see here's the outline, here's the script, and we look at all the media, even the controlled media, and it can't avoid it. We see it all coming to pass. Now, I'm not saying that what is happening right now is going to be the fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 39, but I can say it could be. The point is, we see the world being aligned for this. We see the stage being set, the actors readied, all the props in place, the curtain's about to go up. And so there's a world that is not aware of these things. And we need to make them aware. In the tribulation, we have this admonition in Luke 21. Says, even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize the kingdom of God is near. Keep on alert at all times, pray in order that you may have strength to escape all these things about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. Well, that's the message for that time, for sure. But there's a principle that we can apply today, and that is we need to escape from the wrath to come. Because if you don't come to Christ now, when the church is removed, the only thing that's left is a false church. You're never going to get the true gospel from them. And there's going to be massive deception, much greater than today. And the opportunities are very limited. And the result is that you need to escape now from the things that are coming then. So if it's you know, true then, it's true now. And if you're here and don't know the Lord Jesus in a personal way, you've never put your trust and dependence upon him. I mean, it's as simply as when he hung on the cross and he said, Father, forgive them. You say, Father, forgive me. Forgive me. You know, he died for my sins as a sinner. And if you recognize that you're a sinner and you trust in the one who died for sin, then he'll do exactly what he came to do, and that is he'll forgive your sin and he'll make you his child. And so we come to the last thing. What I've said is not meant to scare us to death, but to lead us to life. And there are always those two decisions or choices that stand before us. And God helps us to make the decision that leads to life. But one door can only be entered through the cross, and we have to come through him. The other is open, and we're already on the path through it until we have come to Christ himself. The fact is, people talk about the Middle East, and they hope that peace will be born there in some way through some diplomatic process. Well, may I say, the only hope for peace was born in the Middle East, and his name is Jesus. Okay? And that is our great hope. Time is running out for planet Earth, but there's still time for any of us to come to him. So, Pastor, if you'll come and explain that for us.